Welcome to the This Is Money podcast in partnership with NSNI, your weekly roundup of the top personal finance, consumer and business stories that editor Simon Lambert and his team have been covering on their award-winning website. I'm your host, Georgie Frost, and alongside Simon Nye today is knowledge and product editor Laura Wickham. And this week, it's the dream, downing tools, hanging up your suit and jetting off into the sunset. But can you really retire at 50? We focus today on financial freedom and what it takes to achieve it. And, well, whatever age you manage it, how do you invest your money in retirement? Also today, decide if it's right for you. What? Is NatWest's new offering, a 0.01% savings account, right for anyone? Surely this was some sort of oversight. Simon went looking for answers. And while banks have been slow to pass on the interest rate to savers, it's time to take a bow, NSNI. We also look at whether debt could be holding you back from getting that dream job and why people in Bristol have cause for frustration. All that and plenty more coming up. And don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NSNI, giving you 100% security for your savings, backed by HM Treasury.
But first, do you dream of an early retirement, waltzing out of the office safe in the knowledge that you have the next 30 to 40 years to do whatever you want? I don't necessarily mean giving up work altogether, but this is about choice. And if that is you, well, the state pension is unlikely to be your route to financial freedom, and waiting for the lottery win is possibly a bit of a gamble. So it's time to take matters into your own hands. And yet we know only half of us are saving enough for retirement. So how possible is it? Now, Simon, just explain. This is off the back of an email you got from a reader who wants to retire at 50, wondering if he can. I'm just curious, is this a common question you get asked about how to retire early? Why would someone even want to retire at 50?
Well, this was something from our Money Pit Stop column, where people email us with their investments and then we get an expert to look through them and suggest what they're doing right, what they could be doing better and how they could maybe get better returns. And this was an interesting one because Kevin is 36. He lives in Bristol. He's a self-employed mechanical engineer. And no, he's not on blind date. He wants to retire by the age of 50. And he runs his own business. And what he wants to do is invest the profits from his business and also a couple of buy-to-lets he's got to build up an investment portfolio that will provide him enough money to retire between the age of 45 and 50. To which the obvious question is, why would you want to do this? Now, apologies to those of our listeners who are past the age of 50. We're using the age of 50 because it's what was put forward in this article. But also, I think it's one of those things where I think a lot of people may be in their mid-30s, their early 40s, think about that as it's a round number for a start. And they think, yeah, 50, I'd like to retire at 50 or in my early 50s. So why would you want to do that? Well, this ties in with this whole niche but growing financial independence movement. There's a number of bloggers who write about this. And the idea behind financial independence is that you've got enough money that you never have to work again. Or if you do work again, you do it on your terms. It might be that you get to 50, you decide that you really enjoy your job and you want to keep working, but you've got the choice. And if you decide that actually you don't like your boss, or you don't like your job, or you don't like your commute, or you don't like any of those many other things, or you just fancy doing something different, you could stop and go, I'd rather enjoy the rest of my life. I'd rather do something that I find enjoyable, and maybe I'll work a couple of days to get some extra money in. Or maybe there's people out there who think I'd rather not do it at all. And to be perfectly honest, I can see the attraction of this, and this is why I've got quite an interest in it. I've read lots about it.
Most people probably see the attraction of that.
So when my youngest daughter will be 18 when I'm in my early 50s, at which point I would love to have the choice to go, okay, pack them off to university, not my responsibility anymore. Maybe I'd like to do something different. I'd quite like to move to the mountains, spend the winters skiing and snowboarding. There's definitely an attraction in doing that while you're still young enough to enjoy it, rather than waiting until you're 65, 67, when, you know, hopefully I'll still be fighting fit when I'm 65, 67, but I've got a better chance of being fighting fit when I'm 52.
But so, Simon, there must be a lot of people in their 50s listening with their kids that have shipped off to university. If you think that's it and you cut the financial ties, then bad luck, Simon.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's where we will start to come into a minute. just how hard is this, and just how hard will you have to save, and what are all the things that you need
all
to
right.
think about?
But I want to know, and you're absolutely right, I have been reading a lot more articles about this in magazines and blog posts and the like, Laura. Are they just selling as a dream? Is this just for the super rich? What does financial independence really mean to you in your mind as well?
Well, like Simon said, it's about choice, isn't it? But to be realistic about that, that means paying off your mortgage, not really having any major financial commitment anymore. And to get to that point, you would have to radically slash your expenditure, as well as hope for the very maximum from your investments. So you have to have a combination of financial know-how. You have to have the financial capability in the first instance to be able to take care of all of your bills, even if they're diminishing over time. And then you've also got to have the willpower to see it through. Every January, I usually try and reassess my finances, think, right, this is the year I am going to make lunch every day I go to work. I'm not going to spend money on sushi and fresh salad and all of the other stupid things I fritter money on during the week. And yeah, that's all right until maybe the end of February.
Sure. And then I'm
back to pots of sushi and thinking, oh, you know, what's the point? And okay, I'm trivialising the matter, but you have to be prepared to make some really hard choices to try to stick to the goal of becoming financially independent, whether it's going to be in 10 years, 15, 20. You know, like there's some figures that have been bandied about that you have to reduce your disposable income by about 70%. I wouldn't be able to pay any bills.
You say you trivialise it, but, you know, every year about January time, we get loads of articles, don't we, written about how much you could save by not spending on coffee, by not spending on going out for lunch. And you're talking actually couple of thousand, so this isn't trivial. Simon, I don't know if you did this for any particular reason other than to make me feel really bad, but you actually sent me an online calculator to work out if I can retire early. And I have to be honest with you, Simon, 40 years apparently, and I'll give you a little bit of a clue, I will not be in my 50s in 40 years' time. That doesn't give away my age too much, but Laura, did you take that?
So I am about to turn 34, and it said that I would have to continue working for another 70 years.
70.
But, you know, I'm on part-time, I've had a baby, my finances are probably not what they went for, but it was a very bad way to start the day.
But Laura makes a good point there, you know, mums, people on part-time, is this ever a possibility for them, Simon?
Yes. So I must admit that link I sent you was a little bit brutal. It was to a rather realistic calculator, and I did plug some numbers into that and then swiftly closed down that tab on the internet and decide that I'd go for my own more glass half full approach to thinking about retiring in my early 50s. If you're interested in this, I'd recommend doing a bit more reading on stuff that's a bit more soft focus around the edges. That's very realistic about what you have to do. There's a blog called The Escape Artist. There's stuff on another blog that we mention regularly here, Monovator. There's other blogs around the UK. There's a guy in the US called Mr. Money Moustache. There's various things. Just basically Google financial independence. You'll find loads of stuff on this. But is this just for the rich? Not necessarily. So it is a truism. Most people spend most of the money that they earn. And the more money you earn, the more you tend to spend. And you start to think of things as being essential to your lifestyle that are not really essential. All that keeping up with the Joneses stuff. And the classic one that you always see in those typical upper middle class, I got into loads of debt, I ran it all up, and then I put it on the credit cards, and now I don't know what to do, my family's in trouble, is always in there. The thing that tips them over the edge is private school fees. Yeah. Now, we do live in a country where, fortunately enough, we have a good education system, and that's not an essential. It's not worth crashing your entire family finances for the sake of not moving them into a state school. So it is a truism that people tend to spend most of the money they earn, but it's also true that the more money you earn, the easier it is to save or invest your money, because there's a certain level at which you need a certain amount of money in order to just get by. And even if you shave your outgoings to the bone, the more you earn, the easier it's going to be to have that gap above it. But I do think if you're interested in this, it's not just something to give up on because you think, well, I'm not a high earner. Because actually, if you're not a high earner, you're used to lower expenditure. And so you'll probably be expecting a lower income in later life that you can live off. So if you earn £100,000 a year, you might be thinking, well, I can't be financially independent until I can get at least 50 grand a year that I can live on. If you earn £25,000 a year, you might think, well, if I could get 15 grand a year, I could be financially independent. So you can think about it that way. But it is true, when you look at is this actually possible nowadays, that it is a lot harder. Lower stock market returns over the past sort of 10 to 15 years than they were in the 10 to 15 years before that. Lower interest rates. So in terms of saving, you're not going to get there by saving. You're going to have to invest. Lower bond yields, so the safe bit of your portfolio, you're going to get a lower yield on that. And if you want then safe income once you do your retiring early, you're going to get a lower income off it. Just look at annuity rates and things like that. But I did some figures, and this is quite scary, but less scary than that calculator.
Soft focus. Is
more
that,
soft
yeah,
focus.
Right.
So if you've got £50,000 saved and invested now, okay? So most people don't have that. But let's say you're starting from a position where you're in a good position already and you saved £1,000 a month and you could get 5% returns. If your goal is £500,000, and with £500,000, if you work on a 4% natural yield or withdrawal rate, you get £20,000 income from that. Maybe you might decide that's enough. How long do you think it'd take you to get to £500,000? Start at 50 grand, you save £1,000 per month. 19 years. It's quite a long time, but it's not too bad. Then if you double your saving to £2,000, and this is where it starts to get extreme, because who can save £2,000 a month? It would only take you 12 and a half years. So you've got to save a lot of money, and you've got to save hard. And the variables are, when do you want to retire early? How hard will you save? Could you really do this extreme 70% of your income? Or could you do 40% as a maximum? Is 25% a maximum? And what's the return you can get? Now, you can only control two of those things. You can control the age at when you want to do it, and you can control how much you save. But the return you're going to get, that's going to depend on the market. And then there's the question of what kind of thing do you invest into, which we can go into in a minute.
We will do indeed. I just wanted to know, because we started by asking about your Money Pit Stop reader, and I should point out he was not frustrated of Bristol. That's another story coming later on. What was advice given there? What was his situation?
Okay, so the scenario was that he wanted to invest £15,000 to start off with, but planned to invest at least £1,000 more, if he can, every month for the next 10 years. But he's got property and mortgages. So he's got a flat with a mortgage of £202,000 on it, but it's worth £400,000. And then there's a flat that they're in the process of purchasing with no mortgage that's got a value of £56,000, and a house with no mortgage that he's got a 50% share in that's got a value of £140,000. So you can see that it's quite heavily skewed towards property there. And if you've got that, the property, and you can get the income from the property, then that is one way to start providing you with an income. And he's talking about taking that rental income and then reinvesting it to sort of double up the returns. So the advice that was given here was to do this tax efficiently to begin with. So to think about doing that into an advice. So this advice came from Wayne Berry, who's a investment manager at wealth manager Brewin Dolphin. So you want to think about doing it into an ISA. You want to think about paying some money into a pension. And he said, if I were Kevin, I would invest into a portfolio which is split roughly 42.5% UK equities, 42.5% overseas equities, that's shares, people, and the balance split between alternative investments such as infrastructure, absolute return, and specialist investments such as private equity. So it's a broad portfolio, and then you've just got to hope for the best. And he said, if we take a retirement age of 50 for Kevin, and he saves the minimum £1,000 per month for the next 14 years, gets a compound return of 4.5% in real terms after inflation, he'd have about £250,000 at retirement. And to be honest, £250,000 is not going to deliver you a huge income. And that just shows quite how difficult this is, because Kevin's starting from the position where he's actually managing to save and invest quite a lot of money.
More generally speaking, though, I did say at the start, Laura, about how 50% of us, we reckon, are not saving enough for retirement. Do we need a bit of a cultural mind shift when it comes to the way that we think about our futures?
I think so. And I think that it doesn't matter how old you are. I think everybody needs to change focus. I'm in a situation where my parents are in their late 50s, early 60s. My mum retrained when she was about 50, and she doesn't have a pension. She's always, for the last sort of 15, 20 years, she's been thinking, oh, well, you know, I might change jobs and I'll need the money to put myself through university. Maybe I'll pay a bit more down on my mortgage so that I can get rid rid of the mortgage rather than build up my pension pot. But what I think what she's come into the realisation of is now, okay, yes, she's retrained, she's got that steady job and the mortgage is coming down, but what's she going to have to live off even when those mortgage payments are smaller? You know, she hopefully will be around for another 30, 40 years and she feels it's too late. Then I've got a younger brother who's in his mid-20s and he's a teacher, hasn't earned very much. He lives in London, massive rent. He's got, you know, a teacher's pension, which is more generous than lots of people's. But, you know, he's only doing the bare minimum that's sort of required. And he hasn't got enough savings for a deposit, let alone being able to top up his pension. And the general advice is you should be putting away as a percentage half your age. Say he's, you know, in his late 20s, to put up to 15% away of his salary. You know, that's a massive thing. So people are always thinking of the near term, you know, real demands on their finances, then thinking what's going to happen to them, you know, as we get older. But by ignoring that, we're kind of setting ourselves up for a fall. And I think with a lack of financial understanding for the public at large, how do you know where to start? We hope that people will come to websites like ours and read our articles and start taking some action. But I think it is a really difficult thing to approach. So I think it almost needs a change of culture.
Do you reckon we're going to get it from the government? We've got a budget looming, haven't we? Just quickly, pensions are low-hanging fruit in the past.
Yes, although the thing that's being trailed is that Philip Hammond might actually go hunting for a little bit of the incentive that people have to save and hack back at pension tax relief from higher earners, maybe to bump up it for lower earners, which would be a good thing. I think the problem is what you need to do, and this relates back to the financial independence thing, is if you read a lot of these blogs, what they say is you've got to keep your eyes on the prize. Thinking long-term goals, short-term goals, keeping your eye on the prize. And I think that's where it comes into how the pensions industry works and the government works, and that, for example, the letters that you get from the pension, your pension company, your pension statement, things like that. I know that I've been in a discussion with you and a behavioural economist before who suggested that basically pension companies shouldn't even be allowed to send out letters unless they got a certain amount of engagement to them. But there was a talk in that discussion around how do you kind of get those little prizes, those little wins to make people go for the big win. So if you go back to the financial independence thing, take our theoretical example of the person who wants to retire in their early 50s and go off to the mountains. What are they going to do? How are they going to slice this whole thing? Once you start breaking it down, then it starts becoming a bit easier to think about. So you're going to need to be saving some money every month. You're going to need to be investing it because you're not going to get the returns from a saving account. Invest it in an ISA, because if you invest it in an ISA, when you start to draw on that money, it's going to be tax-free. So you've got to get as much as you possibly can into that ISA. Now, what's the other major element of your finances that you have that's a long-term savings vehicle? That's your pension. Now, you should definitely put as much into your pension as you get the benefit from your employer putting in. So if your employer will match you, if you put up to 5% in, so you end up getting 10 in, put in 5 because they'll put in 5. Hey, they might even, if you're really lucky, they might even double it up to a certain point. So maximise that out. And that's going to be growing for years and years and years. Now, the only problem with your pension on the whole financial independence thing is you probably can't get at it as early as you want. At the moment, you have to be 55. That's probably going to be 57 within not so many years. So if you want to retire in your early 50s, you're going to need to fund yourself in the gap. The problem you have is that once you do that financial independence thing, you're not going to be putting any more money into your pension, are you? But if you started early, the magic of compounding will mean that actually that's not going to be quite as important, because your pension pot will be going up on a bigger number and a bigger number and a bigger number each year. And then the other thing that comes into it is your house. I think it would be very difficult to do the financial independence thing unless you had a mortgage-free house. Every month, pay your repayment mortgage. Now, the beauty of that is you're slowly buying a house. And at the end of it, if you can get that mortgage cleared by the time you've got your theoretical financial independence age, early 50s, then you've got this big asset that's going to probably be worth a couple of £100,000 or maybe more that you might be able to draw on in some way. Because you could potentially, you're going to have to live somewhere, but you could downsize. You could decide that actually financial independence is worth you moving to a house half the size. You might discover that you could potentially rent your house out and move into another one. The only problem is with that, and with downsizing in general, is a lot of people think about downsizing to help fund their retirement. And then they get to retirement and they realise that actually they don't want to move. They quite like this house they've lived in for the last 10, 20 years, that they don't want a smaller house.
Or at the moment, it's quite hard.
They need all the... Yeah, it's quite hard. It's more expensive than they think. They won't get as much money out of it. Their kids are still living at home because they can't afford to buy their own home. They were expected to look after their grandkids, so they need somewhere to put them. So it's not necessarily that easier. But if you take all of those ingredients and put them together, that's the recipe for financial independence. But it's hard. I mean, it's hard for people to retire at the age of 65 or 66 or 67 with enough money to have a comfortable retirement. So to do it in your early 50s is going to be very hard work. And you've got to decide whether it's worth it and whether it's worth giving up all those things that you'll give up between the age of 35 and 50 in order to do it.
And we did actually get some stats, didn't we, talking about the number of young people living at home. It is quite extraordinary how many people are under the age of 34. So if you thought you were shipping off your daughter at 18... No, you're not. So in sum, basically, how possible is it to retire early? Not massively possible. But how do you live off what you have saved anyway? You did mention investing in retirement, Simon. What was once relatively straightforward, you buy an annuity, you have a final salary scheme, has been tipped upside down since the introduction of the pension freedom. So once you've built up that pot of money, how on earth do you invest in retirement? Well, Justin Urquhart-Stewart from Seven Investment Management actually spoke to Simon and told him it's a very different scenario that people face now.
Well, first of all, one thing they must do is tear up those old investment books which told you what to do just 10 or 15 years ago when you retired, because we were always told as you got older, the proportion of your money that was in fixed interest and in government gilts continued up. But of course, that now is lethal, because gilts, because of what's happened, you've seen the yield come down, the price go up. Now those interest rates are going to go up, albeit slowly. That's going to be a desperately wrong thing to do. So the rules have changed in 20, 30 years. So now we've actually got to say to clients, right, now you've got to start on the assumption you're retiring at, say, 65, 70, you've got another 30 years to earn finance, not 5 or 6 years. Therefore, you're going to have to treat the next lot of your life almost some of the earlier parts. You've got to be in those growth stocks and funds as well, which are going to give you growth and some income, maybe to roll up over that time. Now is not the time to suddenly go into all your defensive things as if you were just going to be retiring now and lasting a few years, because what was defensive 15 or 20 years ago now could be seen to be very risky indeed. The no-risk investments of the 10-year gilt, I'm afraid, is now a risky investment. And really what people need to think about, and some funds do this, they unitise it. So in effect, you almost blend capital and income together. And if investors can think like that, I've got 30 years to go, I've got my £100,000, and if at the end of it I end up with small change, then I've succeeded. So it is a matter of actually using growth and income over that period of time to give you the sort of return you actually need. If you're just purely basing that return just on income alone, you may be forcing yourself into investments which are paying too high a yield. And if it's too high a yield, the chances are there's something wrong with the business and the dividend's about to get cut or something more desperate will happen to it. So don't stress about the income. Be prepared to use some of the capital gain as well. You've got a capital gains tax allowance. Use that to your benefit and so spread it out over time. And if your children want to have something, good. That's where you have a grandfather clock. They can have that.
Justin Urquhart-Stewart from Seven Investment Management there. Laura, if you would just firstly remind us of the pension freedoms, the decisions that people need to take now. Why has the landscape changed so much?
So the big change is that you don't have to buy an annuity anymore, which is good news for lots of people because the rates are rubbish, and you're able to take the first 25% of your pot tax-free.
Which I'm sure is great, lots of choice. Annuity's not that popular, but choice is... We don't like choice. You spoke about behavioural economics a little bit earlier, didn't you? So lots of options. What should we do?
Well, with choice comes responsibility.
Exactly.
And the responsibility to make sure that you have enough money to live on for the rest of your life is quite a big one, actually, especially when you consider the fact that normally when people are investing to build up a pension, they just do what their employer tells them. So their employer says, you put in this much, we'll pay in that much, and then you can decide where to invest it, or you can choose this default option. And everyone looks at it and goes, default option, please. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, when you get to retirement, you then, if you don't have a final salary pension, you have to take your pension pot and decide how you're going to deliver an income for the rest of your life. In the old days of getting an annuity, it was simple. You bought the annuity and the annuity provided that. Now, most people like to keep their pension invested or draw on it and take it as cash, but you don't want to take your whole pension as cash and try and live off that. You won't have a particularly rich retirement. But where do you invest it and how do you invest it? You've got to think slightly differently, because what you're not doing now is accumulating. What you're doing is, in financial parlance, decumulating, aka spending your money. So you need to work out how much money you need, what you've got, and then you need to work out how you match those two things up. And I think one of the things in Tanya's article is for people to think in the old-fashioned way of, now I must take no risk. And Martin Bamford, financial advisor of Informed Choice, said you shouldn't necessarily invest more cautiously in retirement than you did before. He said, we tend to keep portfolio risk level very similar to before retirement, but we allocate more to cash so there's money to cover income needs for at least 3 years. And what that means is, instead of going super cautious, you need to try and keep some growth coming in for your portfolio. But then where do you invest it? That's the really difficult thing that people find. A lot of them just go, okay, well, I'll go for an income fund that pays me the most income. And if you can then withdraw about 4% just above the natural yield of the stock market, you'll slightly run down your pot every year. But you need to make sure that you're spreading your investments around a selection of different funds that draw their dividends from different places. Because if you just put it into a UK equity income fund, most of those just rely on a small number of big FTSE 100 companies for their dividends. And most of those are at risk of all being hit by the same problems at any given time. Another option is things like investment trusts. Investment trusts are good because they can keep some money over in the good times to help pay the dividends in the bad times. And then the other thing is to think about the tax element. And Laura talked about the 25% tax-free lump sum. You can then put that into an ISA so that when you then draw on it, it's tax-free. But with the rest of the money, actually, you should maybe be spending your pension last.
Yes, there is an article about this, and you've got financial experts dishing out advice to retirees worried about their heirs being landed with a big inheritance tax bill. And the advice is, hoard your pension, spend other available cash and investment first. So spend your pension last. Explain.
Yes. So a pension now has inheritance tax benefits in that you can now pass on your pension to the beneficiaries. It sits outside of your estate, but the tax on passing on an outstanding pension is now much lower. So if you die before the age of 75, the people who inherit your pension can do so tax-free, effectively. If after the age of 75, they can inherit your pension, and then when they draw on it, they'll pay tax at their marginal rate of income tax. So basically, what that income added to their other income, what tax band that puts them in. So there's an inheritance tax benefit, but there's also just a standard tax benefit. If you retire and you've got some pots of money, you've got a cash ISA, you've got some investment ISA, and then you've got some standard savings accounts. Well, the interest that you get from the cash ISA is tax-free. Any dividend income that you get from the investing ISA is tax-free. But also, if you withdraw money from those pots, you don't pay any tax on it. Whereas if you withdraw money from your pension, you do pay tax on it after that initial 25% that's tax-free. So actually, it can make sense to take money out of those other pots first and save the pension for last, because in that way, you will be minimising the amount of tax that you pay. And by minimising the amount of tax that you pay, you end up with more money in your pocket. And then if you do end up not spending your pension and passing it on, it's inheritance tax friendly.
Well, that's saving for retirement all sorted. What about saving for the less distant future?
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, making saving that little bit more exciting.
We got a 0.25% rate rise last week, and goodness me, we couldn't cope with all the news stories about banks stampeding to increase rates on their savings accounts. That's not exactly the truth. Remember Simon's story last week on the podcast about discovering NatWest's pretty offensive, I think I called it, 0.01% offering? I asked, did no one in the whole company just take a look at that and think, should we not? Should we just not bother? Well, Simon, a bit between his teeth now, he took it a step further. He went to the bank to try and get a senior bod there to explain. And Simon, what happened?
Well, forgive us for rehashing old ground here, podcast listeners. But last week, when we were talking about interest rates going up and we were talking about savings rates, I did a little bit of Googling while we were recording, and I discovered one of Britain's worst savings accounts. And the way that I discovered this was because NatWest is promoting it on its front page. And this is its Instant Saver. And it had the wonderful line in there, when you clicked through, decide if it's right for you. The instant saver pays 0.01% interest. And my question was, what thought process would you need to go through for the answer to be yes, it's right for me? That interest would be 10 pence on £1,000 in 1 year. So I thought we'd ask NatWest what they were thinking in offering such an account. And I called them up and I suggested that maybe they might like to get a senior person to explain the answer to this question. The question was, why does NatWest think that it is acceptable to offer a savings account with a 0.01% rate?
Fair question.
The answer that came back was not from a named senior person in the bank, I should add. We offer a range of savings accounts to meet our customers' needs. These include our Savings Builder account, which pays up to 1.5%. For first-time buyers, we also provide a Help to Buy ISA, which pays 2%. Savings Builder has been our most popular account for some time now and illustrates our commitment in helping customers to save on a regular basis. Now, can you spot the problem with that answer to the question?
Where's the one that you flagged up?
Doesn't mention the account we were talking about at all, does it? And definitely doesn't answer the question of why does NatWest think that it is acceptable to offer a savings account with a 0.01% rate. So there you have it.
It's good to know. Even we the made editor the request, of a major publication them, can get fobbed off like the rest of us.
We said to them, why do you think this is okay? And they couldn't be bothered to explain it to us. Now, the boss of NatWest is the boss of RBS, a certain Mr. Ross McEwan. And if you read RBS's statements that he has been putting out and the interviews that he's been putting out, he's been talking about rebuilding trust. In the latest set of RBS results, it was headed with the claim that the bank's plan was to build a strong, simple, fair bank for customers, and that it had a target of being the number one bank for customer service, trust and advocacy by 2020. I will leave people to make up their own mind on this. All I'll say is this rate pays 0.01%. Now, there are some other guilty parties here. HSBC also has one that pays 0.01%. The average account pays 0.39% instant access savings account. The Best Buy pays 1.31%. NatWest mortgage standard variable rate is 3.75%. Cheapest two-year fixed 1.55%. Best personal loan rate 3.4%. Credit cards charged between 11.1% and 37.1%. And its net interest margin, which is the profit between savings and loan interest, is 2.93%. And what you might notice about all those numbers is they're a little bit bigger than 0.01%.
They are. So Ross, if you're listening, I know you're a regular listener to the show, then do let Simon know. It's editor at thisismoney.co.uk. Well, we know the banks are being rather slow, should we say, Laura, to pass on the rise to savers. But it's not all bad news. Hurrah for our partners. NS&I confirmed they will be passing on the full base rate, including the odds on premium bond prizes. Here's Chris Dowsett from NS&I.
We have obviously got a market objective to achieve, and we try to reflect our interest in balancing the interests of our savers, the taxpayers and the broader financial market. And we felt that with the base rate rise, it was our chance to do that, to maintain a competitive position in the market. And we feel that these rates going up by 25 basis points are achieving that. It has been a tough time, and that's why we wanted to increase our rates and hopefully give them a bit of a better chance. And certainly with premium bonds, the odds have improved from 30,000 to 1 to 24,500 to 1. And the prize fund rate has also increased from 1.15 to 1.4. So we're giving out, I think, circa 600,000 more prizes each month. The value of that prize pot every month is going up to just under 3 million. That applies from December's draws. So all the rates on all our variable products are coming into effect from the 1st of December, and that includes premium bonds. The only difference for premium bonds is that if you buy now, as is the way that premium bonds work, you have to have your bonds in the draw for a full month before they become eligible. So if you buy today, you will have the chance to win more prizes come January. All our rates are going up by 25 basis points, so our direct ISA will now pay 1% from the 1st of December, direct saver will pay 0.95%, income bonds will pay 1%, investment account will pay 0.7%, and our junior ISA will go up to 2.25%. We feel that our rates continue to meet the needs of our savers, but they also balance the interest of taxpayers and the broader stability of the financial services sector. We continue to review rates on a regular basis, and we make any suggested changes to HM Treasury who agree as appropriate. So we'll continue to watch the market to see what it does, and we'll react accordingly when and if that ever happens.
So that was Chris there. We also have a new Best Easy Access savings account, which we'll get onto in a moment. But first, Laura, if NS and I can do it, why can't the others?
Because they don't want to.
Okay,
I think it's
enough.
As simple as that, isn't it? Savings rates are abysmal. I have a confession here. I have the NatWest awful, awful savings account.
I think
account
I've got the HSBC one as well. So.
Just referred to. I mean, when savings rates are so low, are people really going to put themselves through the hassle of changing when they're not going to get an awful lot of uplift? Yes, if you've got a lot in your savings pot, of course it makes sense to look around, try and get the best rate you possibly can. But, you know, the rates are pretty disastrous. Even in our the top of our Best Buy savings, we've got Paragon Bank that have gone to the top of the Easy Access table today. Their rate's 1.31%. Congratulations, then. They have managed to beat RCI Bank and BM Savings just by a whisker of 0.01 percentage points. So those accounts both pay 1.3%. You know, it is difficult to get excited, though, isn't it?
Now, I am conscious, though, Laura, up until this point, we have really focused on the haves. And now I think it's sort of a moment to focus on the have-nots, because we know that debt is causing many a sleepless night in the country. And it's not just for the individuals. It impacts the government, the Bank of England. They're also really concerned, too. The amount that we're borrowing, it hit over £200 billion. Now, it can cause all sorts of problems, which I just mentioned there, relationships, sleepless nights, everything. But it could also be costing you your dream job. Now, we're hearing the number of candidates rejected over bad debt is rising. Laura, you're going to have to explain this, because how on earth do recruiters know about your financial issues?
Okay, so it does depend on the job you're going for. In general terms, if you're applying for a job in financial services or in any job where there's a degree of financial responsibility involved, then it's quite common for the employer to run a credit check against you, and they use all sorts of services from the likes of Reed, where we get our data from today, or PayPal. They've got another massive service. But what the Reed figures show us that for candidates that progressed as far as having a credit check run on them, so they must have gotten, you know, to the end game of the interview process, nearly 2,000 people in the past year were turned down because they failed the financial vetting. Now, what this information all feeds into for the employer is how much of a risk do you pose their company? If you're coming in to look to into a role where you've got direct access to cash or to customers' accounts, are you in a
precarious... So if you're in debt, you're criminal,
you're,
basically. Is that what they're
saying? Well, no, but they argue that if you're in a precarious financial position of your own, then that makes you higher risk in terms of the lengths you may go to ease your position. Now, obviously, for the vast, vast majority of people, it's a damning indictment. It's so far removed from reality. But there is a risk, they say. And I thought the interesting thing about this was not only are people's finances going to be scrutinised when they go for that job and perhaps their dream job, but you don't have to be working in financial services to have your finances scrutinised. Reed said some of the professions where they've seen vetting happen is you could be a nurse, a midwife, you could be a care support worker, a teacher, a teaching assistant. You could be a security officer, a complaints handler. There are all manner of professions. It's not just about the people that have got could literally have their fingers in the till all day, every day.
Simon, what can be done about it? How do you break this vicious cycle as well?
Well, I think there's always been a great irony in the fact that banks insist on being more stringent with their own staff's finances whilst being happy to lend out tons of money that gets people into personal debt in the first place. And the thing I find most disappointing about this is you've got care support workers, teaching assistants, and youth staff. I mean, these are three jobs that are incredibly hard, quite lowly paid. And so the people in them are probably more likely to end up with precarious finances, yet could then be penalised because of it. I think probably the way forward is if you are an organisation or a company that's going to be doing this kind of thing, is you need to be absolutely upfront with people about it. And then when something comes up that you don't like, you need to make sure that you sit down and you talk it through with that person and that you err on the side of giving them the benefit of the doubt. And if that means they need a little bit more supervision, a little bit more checking up on, say, you can try and make sure that they're not doing anything dodgy, which, let's face it, most people aren't going to do something dodgy, then that has to be the case that you do it. Because what it shouldn't be, and what you really worry about, is that these poor people just go for these jobs, fail this financial check, and then just get bounced out of it. And they never even find out why they didn't get the job.
And get in more debt because they can't find a job. And actually, conversely, this could be working in their favour. If you've got the support of an employer to help you back on the path, this could work really well. And then you'll probably be a better worker because you'll feel so grateful about it.
Maybe. No. I think that might be a tad optimistic. But I mean, I do see the logic in that. If you were working as a carer or with vulnerable young people, you know, you might have quite a lot of control over their cash, you know, the people that you're helping. It might be the old lady's purse to pay the window cleaner, pay for the milk, go out and get some shopping. And, you know, we do see headlines, don't we, where granny's been tucked up by the carer, you know, goes to court. There are bad people in the world. Bad things happen. But
because those are the people that crashed the economy 10 years ago, weren't they?
Yeah. So I think it would be silly for us to think that financial vetting is the way we ensure that our staff will always be above board and they will never do anything dodgy. But I don't think that's very real.
All right. All right. Well, let's move on from this. And if you happen to be visiting, let's get back to Bristol, shall we? Love Bristol. What are you laughing for, Simon? If you happen to be visiting the fair city of Bristol, my alma mater, if you don't know, love it. Don't be alarmed by a larger than average number of people in the street on their mobile phone, or indeed hanging out of windows. EE and Three customers can also be united with Disgruntled of Bristol for those with the poorest phone signal. But it isn't restricted to those demographics either. Nearly a third of mobile phone users in the UK are stuck with rubbish signal. And that's actually an improvement on last year by a whopping 5%. Why is the problem so bad? Can we stop talking about this? 30%, Simon.
It's astonishing, really, isn't it, when you think about it? I mean, I suppose there's two ways of looking at it. One, do you really want an extra proliferation of mobile phone masts and mobile phone transmitters booming things out into the airwaves? But two, it's astonishing how many places you cannot get any mobile phone reception that are not really off the beaten track. Mm. Bristol, for example, I believe is reasonably well known to people.
It's basically in London as well.
My mother-in-law's house, not quite so well known to people, but just on the outskirts of the M25. You cannot get any mobile phone reception in her house. If you want to use the phone, and this is on all providers, I should add, you either have to go stand on the pavement by the road at the front of the front garden, or walk all the way up the top of the back garden. And I was there the other day, and my sister-in-law walked into the house. She's like, "Are you going out?" I was like, "No, I'm just making a phone call." And I just stood out in the road with my coat on. It's crazy, really.
The number of times I'd lock myself out of the house if I have to do that. Laura, this was your story. What can be done about this?
Well, I would say prevention is better than cure. So if you are thinking about networks, changing networks in the first place, all of the big providers have a checker. You can pop your postcode in and just see what the general reception is meant to be like. That said, we've got a case study of a lady called Summer, and she lives
in Bristol.
She doesn't live in Bristol, actually. She lives just outside Manchester in Bolton. Now, she lives quite close to a retail park. So she's not in the middle of the sticks, but she lives in a retail park that is surrounded by quite a lot of greenery. There's quite a lot of trees.
I think I know the very one. Is that near the football ground? Yeah,
I have
possibly.
No idea.
Anyway.
You could be describing any modern built football ground in the country. They are. That could be Derby, that could be Bolton.
Mobile phone reception is terrible among lots of them, I have to be honest, especially on match day. Sorry, Laura.
But Summer in Bolton, who lives in this small development, she and her neighbours all struggle with signal. So Summer has to resort to hanging out of her living room window, which is on the third floor, to try and pick up a signal. Now, she's with EE, but she says all of her neighbours have the same problem, and they're all on a variety of networks. However, if you go on to the network provider's checkers, they say that they've actually got quite a good level of coverage. I think Summer would disagree.
Wow. I'm curious on that one, though. If you accidentally drop your phone out of the window. How would insurance cut with no?
That's a good question.
Dodgy ground there.
Yeah, maybe you don't tell.
Probably not. Yeah. What were you
not
doing out the window?
Lying to your insurer. But she says there's actually very little she can do about it. It doesn't seem as easy for her to switch a network. If you do have poor reception and you can change a network, that might solve it. But for a lot of people, shy of moving house or begging for a new mast, there's not much you can do otherwise, unless you can run your phone through your Wi-Fi and use the services of Skype, WhatsApp to keep in touch, you know, through the internet, rather than just be purely reliant on your phone signal. But if you're not getting reception, mobile phone reception, you may also struggle for Wi-Fi.
In terms of,
it's quite difficult.
In terms of contracts and stuff, though, if you have signed it and you've gone through all the checker and it says, like you just said there, that actually, yeah, this should be fine in your area, and you get there and no, it's not at all, what are your rights there? Surely you can get out of the break that contract because you're not getting what you pay for.
Yeah. So it's quite a battle because you have to get your network to accept the fact that there is a problem in the first place. And, you know,
and you're not going to be able to call them, are you?
No.
You know.
And short of them coming to visit you with a phone and testing it out, you know, it can be quite a difficult case to prove. That said, there's consumer rights legislation, and if a contract isn't fit for purpose, the provider is meant to cancel it. But, yeah, it's not a straightforward process.
Well, the good news, I suppose, we spoke about it in podcast past, of BT reducing landline rates.
Yes, you could always use your landline, very old-fashioned.
If you can find one, or you got
yes,
it.
Yes, indeed. I mean, you would hope that the mobile phone providers would let people out of these contracts, but we get stories on a regular basis where people have perfectly good reasons to be allowed out of a contract and the mobile phone providers won't let them. And to be honest, as tempting as it is to do this, the worst thing you can possibly do is just basically stop paying your contract, because they'll come after you for that. So do keep paying the contract, but complain like crazy. Letter to the chief executive with private and confidential, addressee only time on it, and go to any kind of ombudsman you can find and send This Is Money an email, and we'll try and help you out.
Then the second worst thing you can do is hang out your window. It's just dangerous, people. Don't take the risk, okay? This Is Money editor Simon Lambert and knowledge and product editor Laura Whitcomb. You can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes and tell your friends and family and join in the conversation.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, giving you the chance every month to win up to £1 million tax-free.